what Dr. Eric Routley has said or written. Dr. Routley's extensive writings, his work in editing hymnals, and he tells me he's involved with a new one at the present time with a group of Reformed people, and his many speaking engagements have made his name in our times almost synonymous with the subjects of hymnody and music and worship. Dr. Routley, our speaker for today, is a native of England. He was ordained in the Congregational Church in England and Wales. He is a minister of the United Reformed Church in England and Wales, a church body which was formed in 1972 out of the Congregational Church of England and the Presbyterian Church. Currently, Dr. Routley is professor of church music and director of the chapel at Westminster Choir College in Princeton, New Jersey. My first acquaintance with Dr. Routley was through his writings when I studied and began my studies in hymnody and music and worship. His works were called to my attention. The first one which I read, perhaps was his first work too, I don't know. It was entitled The Church and Music, apparently a takeoff from his B.D. thesis of 1946. He has new materials out. They've turned out to be rather expensive, those published by Liturgical Press. The Panorama of Christian Hymnody and an English-speaking hymnal guide, each one sells for $29.50. It's a good thing that the seminary provides faculty members with book allowances so that we can purchase those books, but they certainly are distinguished pieces of work. After my acquaintance with Dr. Routley through his writings, I had the opportunity to hear him speak at a church music conference at the University of Wisconsin in Madison, Wisconsin. And he delighted me and stimulated me to such an extent that I thought whenever I had the opportunity to take a course with him, I should surely do so. In the summer of 1979, I did have that opportunity as I attended a one-week course at Westminster Choir College in Princeton in Christian hymnody. Dr. Routley was the instructor. It was a concentrated course. He lectured for 3 hours in the morning. He lectured for 3 hours in the afternoon. So we had 6 hours a day. And even when we were in that last hour of the day, he was still stimulating and interesting. He's not been allotted 6 hours this afternoon, but I'm sure that you will agree with me after you've heard him for 1 hour that he has the ability, the knowledge, and the capacity to maintain the attention of an audience for 6 hours too. Dr. Routley.
Well, thank you for that delightful, not so effusive introduction. I'm not quite sure, but I think I know, whether I regard it as more of a hazard or more of a privilege to be allowed to address this company here. I am frightened. As one should be in any place with a name like Concordia, if one is a Calvinist. On the other hand, as I was just saying to Wayne, I think your theology may be right, because I've never seen a more beautiful room for doing this kind of thing in than this one. And anybody who knows how to organize things in a way such as is suggested by these beautiful and hospitable premises, they can't be all bad. I am conscious, however, that this is only the third time that I have spoken in a Concordia. I have indeed met some of the Lutheran Mafia at the Concordia College in River Forest. We all know who lives in River Forest. I've also actually got my nose for half a day into the seminary of Fort Wayne. But I feel that I really am at the fountainhead here. And I'm bound to say I don't know what I ought to say to you. So I'm going to say what I believe about music in church. And I'm going to try and say it in a way appropriate to the fact that this room is not primarily filled with musicians. Of course, if you're talking to musicians, you go on and on and on the way he was saying I did. I sometimes feel that there ought to be somebody in the class called Eutychus when I go on for 6 hours a day for 5 days. One of the reasons why people don't fall asleep and fall out of the window is that in the classrooms where we meet there aren't any windows. If there were, I'm sure somebody would. But I like best the opportunity of talking about church music to people whose primary interest is not music. Because if I want to speak on the subject of the pastoral implications of music in church, which is the title that I offered, the pastoral implications of music in church, I am bound to be conscious, and I require my audience to be conscious, that any church music is made in the presence of people who are not musical. Some of it is actually made by them. Now, that is a perfectly sober statement, which is almost entirely overlooked by church music enthusiasts. We love it. I am one. We love it and we enjoy it and we want everybody else to enjoy it. But it is fatally easy to forget what it is like not to be musical. Now, everybody is musical to some limited extent. I know there are some people who are tone deaf, but it is an unusual condition. It's a regrettable condition, like schizophrenia. But you get the occasional one. But actually, there are plenty of people who are not, in the technical sense, musical, who nonetheless get a great deal out of music. The church has always recognized this. It has only been very eccentric kinds of religion that have ever tried officially to do without it. One is rather frightened when one's in the presence of people who really think you can worship without any music at all, like the English Quakers, who are an intellectual aristocracy and are quite happy to have it that way, and they've got so much on their minds they don't need music. That seems to me to be a sort of sad condition to be in. But bless us all, it doesn't matter what sort of religion you have, whether Christian or otherwise, of course there's music. However, in a place like this, where the craft of ministry is taught with, I fondly imagine, a very weighty theological emphasis. And how else can you possibly teach it? When one starts talking about music, the danger is that one will be thoroughly untheological. And will say, yes, of course, that's different. No, it isn't. Any human activity comes within the range of theology. There is something that God has to say about it. There is some direction in which God is directly interested in whatever it is his creatures are doing, including music. And that is the basis upon which I feel ministers of music in churches and pastors, ministers of the word in churches, ought to proceed. Now, I think the pastors are likely to find themselves a little less uncomfortable in the presence of the musicians. And you cannot possibly teach in a place such as that in which I have the honor to teach without knowing that fairly frequently there is discord between pastors and musicians where there ought to be good counterpoint. But a pastor is going to be happier in the presence of a musician if he realizes that their ministry is, at any rate, functionally exactly the same. Because inasmuch as a pastor is a preacher and an administrator of the sacraments, he is preaching and administering in the presence of people who are not, as he is, theological. Now, any pastor knows, I am assuming that this is how you bring them up in this place, that he will not get very far if he takes the line that was taken by a very famous Oxford theologian in the 19th century who was preaching in Christchurch. This is the sort of story that's attributed to various eminences, and I don't know which it was, but it was before most of you were born, in about the 1870s or something, and he was preaching in Christchurch, and he allowed his congregation to assume that they were all highly theological. But when one person who heard it turned to another, he said, "But that was exactly the same sermon that Dean so-and-so preached in a little country church with five old ladies in it last Sunday. And it contained the following epic piece of rhetoric. Leaning over the pulpit in the little country church, as indeed he did in the cathedral, and looking at the five old ladies, as indeed he did at the Oxford theologians, he said to them, 'I can hear you saying it. What I have just said is pure Sabellianism.'" Now, most ministers, I imagine, don't throw communicatio idiomatum and hypostasis, creatures of that kind, at their congregations. Oh, they're walking along the street, they're driving their cars around on their pastoral course, and that sort of stuff is in their mind all the time, but that's not the way they talk. It is the preacher's business to make theology friendly to people who are not professional theologians, and exactly the same way, it's the church musician's business to make music friendly to people who are not musical. Now, in the music that is used in the churches with which you and I are most familiar, there are two streams of music. There is the professional music and the folk music. It's obvious enough. Not only is the organist and the choir director, or maybe a separate person, set aside to make music at a professional level, there is a choir. There are people who will spend 2 or 3 hours a week, even if they are not themselves professional in the sense of being paid for it. At any rate, there are people who have a certain musical ability and under direction can give good results, and they sing and play professional music at a professional level. And on the other hand, there are the folk, the people, the laos, and the people whom we're no longer allowed to call the laity, who are lay in every blessed sense, in every admirable sense, in not being, or not having time to be, at that sense, professionally interested in the subject. And therefore, you have on the one hand organ pieces played before and after the service, and if you are lucky, and if you are in the English tradition, I'm not sure if it is also the Lutheran, in the middle of the service as well, and you have the choir singing anthems by Schütz, or probably not Herbert Howells, but Schütz anyhow. And on the other hand, you've got the hymns. Now, hymnody is what I'm going to talk about tomorrow. And I'm not spending much time on it now, though the odd reference will be inevitable, because hymnody is the music that is made by the unmusical people. And very splendid it can be. Now, when one has establishes that, one then moves on to the point of the two streams of pastors' work. And I always insist that musicians, if they're ministers of music in churches, should cultivate and value some pastoral gift. The pastor is, on the one hand, the nourisher of the sheep, and on the other, their protector. It's his business to see that the sheep get their food, and it's his business to see the wolves don't get them. And it is necessary that either kind of pastor, the musical one or the theological one, be always aware of the vulnerability of the inexpert. Now, I'm not sure that I ought to go too far along the theological line here, because I might get into difficulty. But the musical line is easy to follow. But I think there's a direct parallel between what we say about music and what we say about the Word of God. And what we say is this, that music can have a profound effect on people, which is not necessarily good. Music, irrespective of whether it is well or ill performed, can, if ill directed, do huge damage. The way I commonly put it is to say that if you are technically and professionally musical, you have a built-in faculty that has been cultivated by your teachers and by yourself for rejecting what won't do, for recognizing bad material for what it is. If you are an unmusical music lover, you don't have that faculty. I don't think I'm speaking in any sense moralistically. I think I'm just stating a perfectly obvious fact that if you haven't got it, you may indeed pick up all sorts of things that are not going to do any good. It is not wise, I think, for us to speak too much in terms of parents and children, because nothing is more of a danger to Christian pastors than paternalism. But it surely is true that if you have a child, there are things you warn that child against, because the child has not yet developed the critical faculty which will distinguish between a toadstool and a mushroom, which will distinguish between a berry that is poisonous and a berry that is nourishing. So you say, don't eat those. It's poison. I had an incident, if you don't mind my exercising the privilege of the elderly and extracting something from the past of my lengthening and misspent life. When I was a congregational minister in the city of Newcastle, which is a fine city indeed in England, I came over to the United States on a visit and at once saw something marvellous happening in the church that I thought would be very good in my own, so I took it back and persuaded them to do it, and that was have a coffee hour after the morning service. The English don't do this, you know what the English are, they've got no initiative at all. So I said, let's try this, and it wasn't a coffee hour, it was a coffee hour and a half. You couldn't get them off the premises. You know, the janitor had to come in and sweep them out with a broom. They were enjoying each other so much. It's very nice. Well, on one of these occasions, at which we served coffee for the adults and fruit juice for the children, and I used to use fruit juice, because the coffee served in that church was abundant evidence of the problem of evil. This little girl, age 9, came up with her glass of juice and said to me, "Please, may we have the new tune to O Jesus, I Have Promised?" Well, I didn't say which new tune to mean, 906, because I knew darn well which new tune she meant. It was a singular shocker, but no, you wouldn't know anything about it. You're pure and unspotted from the world. But it was the sort of thing that gets bad in England. I said, "No, you can't." Well, this little girl never heard a minister say no. Because, though we may be Calvinists, we say yes to everything. You know, we say yes. "Oh, yes, yes, we've changed the time of service, turn the service up to back to front, and commit adultery, it doesn't matter. Yes, yes, yes." I said no. And she was a bit downcast. So I said, "It's all right, I'm going to tell you why. I said, you're drinking juice and so am I, but I've just been round into the kitchen to check whether the juice that we serve here contains cyclamates. I don't know how many legs a cyclamate has got, but it was one of the things which we were told was dangerous and carcinogenic and so forth, and we were all being very, in 1966 or so, very serious-minded about cyclamates, and she knew what they were. I said, "I've been round there to see that this stuff you're drinking's all right. It's my job." "Well, cyclamates are poisonous, and so's that tune." I then said, "I'll tell you what we are going to do next Sunday, and I hope you'll enjoy it." We were actually going to give our first performance of Jelly No 135. The children loved it. "Well, you see, I think that we do have to say, no, don't eat that stuff, from time to time." Now, of course, it is easy for toffee noses like us to say, "Yes, we know how appalling the effects of music can be. Look at rock." Well, I'm not quite sure how it is with you people, but most of the Christians I know think that it's a good idea to have rock music in church occasionally. I don't. There are all kinds of deliberately distorted music which reflect the most unlovely aspects of modern culture, against which I think the church ought to set its face. You can go on just so long saying, "Well, there may be something in that," but I've done it often enough and had to eat my words. Somebody has a new theological idea. Somebody has a, God save the mark, a new liturgical insight. Lord, you say, "Well, there may be something in it." You try it, and it falls flat, and it ruins what you're trying to do. The older I get, the more curmudgeonly I become, and I say that there is a certain kind of irresponsible, deliberately irresponsible music that makes people irresponsible. There's a depressing kind of music that makes people depressed. And above all, there is a sentimental kind of music that makes people sentimental, and that must not happen in church. Let me define exactly what I mean by that, because that's one of the very few words that has slightly improved in meaning. Most words, you must have noticed, that are bad words now, or an awful lot that are bad words, used to be perfectly good ones. This is a ghastly word, which I think ought to remain ghastly, and sentimentality is the irresponsible cultivation and expression of emotion for which you do not propose to pay a dime. Sentimentality is next door to cruelty. It's a twin brother of it. The sentimental people are the inconsiderate and the thoughtless ones. And if they get to power, they are the tyrants. From all the easy speeches that comfort cruel men. I'm not sure that him being by a Catholic got into the Lutheran Book of Worship. I forgot to check. That says, as no other does, exactly what has to be said about the generation of irresponsible emotion in church. Now, nobody wants to be cold-hearted. Nobody wants to be unpassionate. Nobody wants to say, ah, when you come into church, you've got to be very demure. But I feel that it is wiser to leave all that kind of thing to the Holy Spirit to do and not manufacture it. Now, there is a kind of music that manufactures it. And people have always known it was there. Augustine knew it was there. The early fathers, though they made a few pretty bone-headed comments about music, because it was very difficult to identify what music was in those days, but they had it in their bones. There was a kind of music that didn't help. And there was a kind of music that did, and if one does extract from people all the way from Origen to John Wycliffe, from the writings of these people, which, as I say, it's no good being fundamentalist about, but if one extracts the common thing that they were looking for and expressing rather badly, it surely is this, that there is a kind of music which helps and a kind that doesn't, and that the kind that helps will be chaste, will be simple, will be the kind that does not manufacture emotion, though it may well arouse it. Now, I think, time I mentioned Luther, isn't it? Yeah. And Luther certainly knew about this. Luther took a very unusual line about it. From the musicological point of view, Luther he wanted his people to have music that they could sing themselves in church. And he wanted it to be, because he knew all about the other kind, the sort of music that would nourish. So he did two things. The one was to build it very firmly into the liturgy, so that the hymns were integral to the liturgy and not adornments of it, as they are in my Calvinist background, for instance, and as they are for other reasons in the Anglicans. There has been no more complete integration of hymnody with liturgy than, of course, there was in Luther's time, and that there remains, I'm sure, in the modern Lutheran church, in those parts of it that haven't gone off the rails. And Luther, therefore, built it into the liturgy, and in the second place, gave people music based on the finest music he could find. I'm sure nobody believes in these sacred walls, where surely, more than in most seminaries, reason reigns supreme. I'm sure nobody believes that Luther introduced pop music into church. Nobody believes that you can justify the appalling corybantic antics of some modern Christians by reference to Luther. The music that Luther used for his model was the highest brow music he could get at that was singable by unrehearsed congregations. That is to say, it wasn't five-part polyphony, such as he would have heard the music of Josquin and Ockeghem and people like that. But it was the court music, the highest kind of entertainment music. And, quite frankly, Luther has been found by everybody except his own people to have pitched it slightly too high. There are 20 hymns by Luther in this green book, which I'm not sure if it's proper to mention in this particular place, but, you've probably seen it. All right, I'll put it back there. There are 20 hymns by Luther in that, and the plain fact is that if you're not a Lutheran, you only know one of them. Possibly one and a half. So everybody knows A Mighty Fortress in what you would regard as a corrupt version. Some people know Von Himmelhoch, and that's about where the Presbyterians stop. Well, I want to say a little more about that when I talk about him today, tomorrow. But I'm quite clear that Luther knew that if a certain kind of demand was not made of the congregation would take mean advantage of being allowed to sing. So did Calvin. So did Calvin in his Genevan Psalms. He said, "You must sing. Indeed, there shall be no music in church that you don't sing. All music shall be made by unmusical people. We will not have an organist, we will not have a choir, we will not have four or five part harmony. You will sing the melody and you'll like it." Being quite clear that there was a Renaissance demand on the part, a sort of semi-humanistic demand on the part of the congregation to have their say and not just sit there, he said, "All right, you shall have it, but I will produce a lexicon of 99 different rules and regulations hedging it about so that you don't take advantage of it and do it wrong." And the result was the Genevan Psalms. And again, if you are not a member of the Dutch Reformed Church, you probably know about two of them. They're marvellous, just as Luther's tunes are. But they haven't exported particularly well. Well now, I shall show tomorrow, I shall give a chapter and verse for the notion that during Luther's own lifetime, some people thought his congregational music a little too difficult. But let that wait. This is the opposite of what, of the attitude that prevails in a very, very large part of the church now, which is, not only let the congregation participate, but let the congregation run it. And the way people behave in some churches, and I, oh, well, you know I'm a foreigner, it's just as bad in England. In fact, it's rather more pernicious because it's a little more hidden. But the way people behave in church is just as if when I get on the plane tomorrow, when we've been going for 15 minutes, I go up and knock on the door at the front of the plane and say, "Now, you've been driving this long enough, let me have a go." Yes, well, it's really surprising that there's been a lot of casualties. You see, we've lost the sense of counterpoint. We've tried to get rid of discord. We've very largely, in the rest of the church, and I inform you of this because you won't know about it, in the rest of the church, lost our sense of the church's authority. We don't think it's fun to be obedient anymore. We think it's degrading, which is a perversion. Our music shows it. And two things happen. Sometimes they both happen in the same place. Either the general taste of the music in a church becomes so depressed that nobody with any sensitiveness wants to go, or the professionals have it all their own way and the congregation doesn't get to sing. There are two situations, one of which, both of which have come within my experience, and no doubt within yours too. I remember going to a church a long way from here and a long way from my own home, but still in the United States, where there was a service, well, it was a Presbyterian church, we needn't be too ashamed of that, and they were having a morning service. Oh, they'd been doing something to the organ, and they wanted to dedicate it, so they asked me along to shout the odds. There was this morning service, and the first hymn was "Praise to the Lord the Almighty," Lobel den Herren, and so forth. In the Presbyterian hymn book's number one, and it has three stanzas, which is a bit mean, took 7 minutes. Not because they sang it with pietistic slowness, but because the organist, after stanza one, took off on a long, long improvisation, keeping the congregation standing about, you know, sort of saying, "Oh, I've got to do something." And then after stanza two, he played up, call out for you by Tacklebell. By Tacklebell, I may say, at his stuffiest. And the congregation was just standing by, and the only other thing the congregation sang was a hymn at the end of the service. Now, there was lots of marvellous music, but it was not difficult to detect. In fact, over lunch, there was the music director, who was an admirable person and a friend of mine, was not present. Somebody was eventually saying, "Yes, we have a marvellous music program, but we do wonder what the congregation has got to do with it." On the one hand, you might get a depression. People saying, if the people want it, they must have it. On the other hand, you will get, if you don't get that, there's only one other thing to get if this is not theologically guided, and that is the professionals running away with the whole program and leaving the congregation stranded. Now, nobody would know better than you people how necessary it is to put back that particular element that has been removed from our thinking about church music. And it is, of course, the element of pastoral theology. The pastor is the protector and the nourisher. He's got to feed those sheep and he's got to see that the wolves don't eat them. And he's got to do it without being a pedagogue, without saying, "Well, it's no good coming in here if you don't know Greek," without saying, "It's no good participating in hymn singing if you can't read the alto clef." No, they've got to feel wanted. It seems to me that the pastor's job is often represented as being the job of making people's pleasure righteous. It is equally the job of people of making righteousness pleasant. But don't let the righteousness go. You see. You're not a pastor. In any sphere, including that of music, if you simply say, "If you like it, it's almost certainly wrong." Now, there are plenty of musicians who've done that. Some of the worst of these musicians have been English. But I have met one or two in other countries who have said, "Oh, if ordinary people like it, it can't be right." No, one has got to recognize the response that people make in a simple way to simple pleasures. But you have not done your work and you've not done your preaching if you don't give people the impression that doing it right is the most delightful thing there could be, because the gospel with which we are charged and by which we are fascinated, the gospel is all about a kingdom in which there is at last perfect harmony between what must be done and what one loves doing. Duty and delight. Or you could put it this way. When people are in church, who are they? Who and what? If one says, "The people want this. The people want it, so they should have it." Where is the fallacy in saying, "Well, they're Christians, they're in church, and so they are entitled to want whatever they do want, and to have it given to them"? Where's the fallacy? Why, here. That if we go to meet the people, and if we attempt to supply their needs and their wants, we are only entitled to supply their wants when those people are at their best. Worship is designed to make it possible for people to be at their best. Worship is not a question of just as I am. You take me or leave me. Which, of course, not what that hymn means, but the reason why I never choose it is a lot of people think it does. It's not that. When people are at their best under the gospel, then indeed they open their mouths and they prophesy, and the dream of Moses comes true. They all do. But that is not to say that when two or three malcontents in a church or two or three rebels lift up their voices and say, we want Geoffrey Beaumont, we want Acid Rock or something, because they've said it in church or in church context, they must have it. No, indeed, a pastor's got to know when to say no. It is, of course, most necessary. And once again, I feel that having lived in Newcastle, I know exactly what it means to bring coals to Newcastle. I feel that I'm rather doing that here, because you probably know more about this than most centres of theological learning. But free and friendly intercourse between pastors and musicians is always necessary. Now, I've told you, I've mentioned one or two abominations of desolation standing where they ought not, but I'm afraid I've got to mention another now. I don't know how it is in the Lutheran church, but in some churches, a pastor is the person who hires and fires the musician and lets the musician know it. And that's about the size of it. Now, suppose you have a musician of decent conscience, perhaps rather pastorally uneducated, though academically extremely skillful. Suppose you have such a musician, and the pastor, instead of saying, "Look, come off it, just prove to me that that's bad music," and if the musician proves it, saying, "Sure, you've made your case, we won't use it," instead of that, suppose the pastor says, "Now, will you stop giving us all this highbrow music? We want the folk music, the guitar music, the music that all young people are clamouring for. Two or three young people were told by their parents to clamour for it, but he says they're all clamouring for it. Where's the musician then?" Well, I tell you, it's happening. Exactly a year ago, a year ago today, I was in my own country, at the Royal School of Church Music, with a conference of about 30 people who had come from the Anglican Communion. I was the only non-Anglican there, all over the world. The Anglican Communion, you know, is a sort of network that is to be found sprouting up, I'm sure to your great embarrassment, in all sorts of parts of the world. We had Australians and New Zealanders and South Africans and Welshmen and people from Mesopotamia and Parthia and heaven knows where. They were all there. Well, they listened patiently to what I had to say, the way people do. But when we came to the question time, they were on like a pack of jackals to one question. What are we to do? Because our ministers are making us perform music we know to be trivial, cheap, and corrupt. What are we to do? There is a certain movement which I need not characterize by a word that has been appropriated for it. A word, a splendid theological word, which has now been made unusual. There is a movement all over the English-speaking world. And affecting most of the denominations, though I suspect probably not yours very much, in which results matter most, in which if people say it has filled the church, they reckon they have justified whatever they did to fill it, in which a cult of personality has debased the ministry so that people now think of the ministry only in terms of some unusually talented and unusually garrulous pastor, and it gets on television all over the country. And you know what music is associated with it. clobber them. Now, I got so concerned about these poor creatures, who were not, who did not despise people who weren't musical. But they were told if they dissented from this kind of thing, they were told by their ministers that they were second-class Christians. They were not only threatened with the removal of their jobs, they were told they hadn't got any religion. Now, this is an abomination, if ever I heard of one. Well, all right, I made a remark about this, and the director of the Royal School of Church Music said, well, I was interested in what you said. Would you write that in the next copy, the next issue of our journal? So I wrote it. I wrote it several times and sent it to him with some fear and trembling. And I shall never be able to go to England again. I was indeed, there were quite a lot of musicians who thought that what I'd say was right, but practically all the clergy really tore me limb from limb. You know, there was one limb here and there was another in the next county. Because I adventure to say that some clergy do not distinguish, when they use the word sacrifice, between what Abraham had in mind on Mount Moriah and what Aaron had in mind when he asked for all those earrings. Now, that's what I call sentimentality. I think it's wicked and terrible and very sad that it's happening. I mean, I know that there are pastors who are oppressed by their musicians. The musician will say nothing written after 1600 is any use. And I refuse to play anything that was. And those people down there, they've got to sing. Well, they can. Perhaps we'll occasionally have something by that young tearaway Orlando Gibbons, who died in 1625. But broadly speaking, it's all got to be. You know these fanatics, these addicts. And I would say, from my place on the fence, that it is bad to be addicted to tunes of Tallis or Genevan Psalms, or by your leave, Lutheran chorales, as it is to be addicted to gospel songs or Victorian English hymns. No, it's this irrationality, which can be worked on by the Elmer Gantries of this world in order to produce what people facilely call success. Well, I think I've said enough, you see, to make my case that music is not an unmixed blessing. C.S. Lewis hated it. Lewis, Englishman. Don't know if he's known here, but he was... there's an awful lot of people in this country who do read him. And he was, as a matter of fact, a person I knew a little. And admired only just sort of idolatry. And I'll never forget how horrified I was when he came out in print as saying that he thought church music, on the whole, was a nuisance and was the dead mood of the service. Nobody ever persuaded him otherwise, either. But you see, he saw hymns as gang songs, as brainwashing. He saw it like that. And he saw the underside, because he was rather good at seeing the underside of practically anything, of what we think is self-authenticating devotion. There is no self-authenticating devotion that is not subject to the gracious dominion of theology, reason, and beauty. Well, that's what we stand for. At this funny little place that I work at. And I conclude by a very hazardous guess, which I certainly don't want to be taken as authoritative, and I don't want anybody to think that I'm pretending to be authoritative when I make it. But I have a congregation of people who could, if we'd hurried up a bit, have been the age of my grandchildren. I shall be a senior citizen next October, and I'm quite proud of this. And here are these youngsters, a few people from the faculty too, but these youngsters, who come to voluntary chapel that we had started in 1975 from nothing. And it's a choir college. A college of professional musicians, and there is no choir in this chapel. Of course not. Chapel's supposed to be a place where you relax and do something different. They're singing choirs all the rest of the time. No choir. It's just a congregation. There is the simplest kind of liturgy. I'm sorry. It's on the Calvinist form. But it isn't any different from yours. Half an hour of it. And no concession is made to the how great thou art of this world. Nobody comes and says they're all wanting so-and-so. We do it, I expect, the way you do it. Without attempting to be popular, without attempting to be anything except faithful to the Scripture so far as we can be. And it's remarkable how unfaithful to the Scriptures one can be even in 4 minutes if one puts one's mind to it. But we do our best. Now, I think the young people of today are going to want it not fussy, not faddy, not trendy, but played straight down the middle. And if somebody says, here is something which you will love doing if you will make the smallest effort, what you'll get from the young is, don't talk to us like that. We will not offer to the Lord what costs us nothing. As King David did in his day. I think they will. Well, that's my guess. That's what I am backing as my own hunch. And I think that anybody who says that the modern young want sensational, sentimental, talkative, trivial, irrational music is insulting them. So, having been saying this for 40 years, in various ways, I'm going on saying it until I am corrected by the Lutherans.
Thank you, Dr. Routley. I've informed Dr. Routley that you would all like to address some questions to him and that we would have some time to do that. He has his Lutheran Book of Worship here, and so Dr. Fremder will perhaps have a few questions about the Lutheran Book of Worship that lies on the table here. Are there any questions that you'd like to have Dr. Routley address? The group is, Mark, are you ready to fire?
Well, I just wanted to say I really enjoyed your presentation. One thing I noticed is that so often you get people saying what you were saying. Why don't we sing this? I belong to a congregation here and think, well, they just added a group of hymns to the back of the hymnal because they're not satisfied with the hymns that were there, you know, and so, and as a pastor who on occasion preaches there, you have a lot of pressure from people. Why don't we sing one of those hymns in the back?
Somebody must have been out of the room. The answer is, I imagine, that the hymn is a precision tool, and you can't think of any purpose for which that was they serve. No.
Let me ask a question, if nobody else has one here, on the function of the organ in the church service. Frequently, as you indicated, the organist plays a prelude before the service.
Yeah.
Sometimes there is a voluntary in the middle of the service.
You have that?
Yes, we have that regularly. It's during the offering.
Oh, well, yes.
And then there's a postlude. Would you be willing to comment on the function of instrumental music, particularly the organ in the service?
I'm all for it, but it does give problems to the player. When I speak of a voluntary in the English style, it is a piece, a very modest piece, played immediately after the gospel, while nothing else is happening, while people reflect on it. It was an 18th century custom that was recovered in Coventry Cathedral, the new cathedral there. We're always getting this, of course, at the college, because we've got a bunch of professional organists there, and they wonder whether they ought to make the organ music part of the service. And I have been to some churches where the service was advertised to start at 11 o'clock and it started with 5 minutes of organ music. Music was not played while people came in, but it was played when they got there. I am not sure about this. I think that to people who are not particularly musical, the sound of the organ is enough to help them realize where they are, even if they are not listening, and indeed are not capable of listening, to what is actually being played. I think it's rather one of the nobler parts of the organist's work to produce a highly professional and very finished performance, which hardly anybody is listening to, and not to mind that they're not listening. And it's very difficult to say to aspiring young organists, especially when you're elderly, as they think this is just because you can't play yourself. I don't know, I wouldn't be want to dogmatize about this, but I think that music played before the service is much better if it is not very noticeable. If it turns out to be an extremely ear-catching tune, I don't think the people in the church are going to be saying their prayers. I think they're going to say, isn't that lovely? Which isn't quite the function of it. If it turns out to be a very ear-catching tune in the middle, I suppose you used it after the gospel, I think people would forget entirely what had been said and what had been read, and would just say, oh, it's lovely to hear the organ. That's not quite what it's there to do. So after the service, the organist is traditionally allowed to make all the noise he or she wants to make. And that means we're all stuck there in the church shouting at each other, trying to drown the organ. If I were a pastor here, which heaven has happily forbidden, I would do what they do before the service at Trinity and what they do after at Coventry. Trinity Episcopal Church is the church we actually go to in Princeton, and they simply have a line in the bulletin saying, 9 o'clock a.m. we'll say, silence in the sanctuary. At 9:15, the service. People have got into the way of not chatting to each other before the service, of using the time before the service for their devotions. And the organist plays from about 9:08 to about 9:13, and there is at least 2 minutes of silence before the processional begins. I think that's very sensible and very good. But at the end of the service, the most dreadful things happen. Because, as I say, people are imprisoned in the church while the organ is making all the noise it can. Why are they imprisoned? Because of this confounded reception line. I don't know if you have one in your office. Any Presbyterian church. They're all waiting to shake hands with the minister. Now, if anybody wants to say more than one sentence to the minister, the whole thing is fouled up. It's of no consequence whatsoever. Your coffee and punch and whatever else you need, sir, that's the time to say everything you've got, the minister can hang about.